Lecture 5, Book of Exodus.
Om, 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 om. The sacred word of God, the word with which you should begin every day, the word with which you should begin every task that you undertake with a free heart, renouncing any concept of remuneration, of ambition or honor, doing it simply because it is your work, your task, it is your karma. Tat, tat, tat. The sacred word of a task being fulfilled for God without any thought of gain or profit. And finally, sat, sat. Sat, sat, the perfect conclusion of a work done for God, the perfect conclusion of your karma. These were the lessons we drew last time from our discussion of the Bhagavad Gita, literally the Song of God, the sacred writing of the Hindu religion, still read by millions and millions every day, read every day by the great Gandhi, who drew from it the lesson to stand fast in the truth. I will not commit an injustice today, Gandhi said, nor will I permit an injustice to be done to me. Gandhi epitomizes the way in which the Bhagavad Gita changed history. Scholars cannot date the work with precision, and the true believer in the God of the Bhagavad Gita and the Song of God would say it doesn't matter whether it is 500 B.C., 10,000 B.C., 2000 A.D., for the lesson is as eternal as God himself. God comes into being, God passes away, or God is eternal. It is not for us to try to solve these paradoxes in our own Western mind. God, God with one portion of my being, he tells Arjuna, I support the universe. But that is less important than simply, I am. I am. And the message of the Bhagavad Gita, those ideas, eternal, would enlighten a young Indian prince, Siddhartha Gautama, who men would call the Enlightened One, the Buddha, who in the latter part of the 6th and early part of the 5th century B.C. would find his enlightenment, and his disciples and missionaries would spread the enlightenment of Buddha, Buddhism, to shape the civilizations of China and Korea, of Tibet and Nepal. A book that truly made history, the Bhagavad Gita. Now, you may not find it on the bestseller list. It may not be everyone's favorite reading for today, but it is an eternal work. And we want in our next several lectures to explore books that have shaped the religious beliefs of generations and of millions. And the book of Exodus in the Bible must surely rank as the most influential book ever written, for it shaped not only Judaism, but Christianity and Islam. The book of Exodus, which traditionally was believed to have been written by Moses himself, one of five books composed by Moses. Since the 18th century, scholars have been busy trying to tear away at that traditional view. Once again, in the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita, I must say it doesn't matter. What concerns us in this book, in this course, is that this magnificent work exists. And what does it say to us? And how has it shaped history? We have looked at the Iliad as a profound sacred work. Remember, the Greeks looked upon it as the Christians did the Bible. And when the Greeks of the 3rd century A.D., living in the Roman Empire, were trying to argue against Christianity, they cited the Iliad as their Bible. It is a tribute, as is the Bhagavad Gita, so the Iliad, to polytheism, and to the richness of a belief that God has fashioned many roads to the truth. Exodus takes just the opposite point of view, as will our study of the Gospel of Mark and our study of the Quran. For Exodus, there is only one path, and the Lord God is a jealous God, allowing you to worship none other beside him. Moses was a real historical figure. And the composition of the book of Exodus, its story, takes place within a true historical context. Egypt, in the great days of Egyptian empire, of imperial power, in which Egypt dominated the Middle East. You must remember that the Middle East has been the crucible of conflict and the graveyard of empires. Empire after empire after empire has passed through the Middle East, seeking to impose its culture, its will, its dominance. And every one of them has failed. So too the young Pharaoh Ramses II in 1275 B.C. led his tank corps, his mobilized forces, great war chariots into Syria and into Iraq, determined to make a preemptive strike against the Hittites, the power dominating what we would call Turkey today. Ran into an ambush. They thought victory had been won, and he ran into an ambush and was nearly overwhelmed by the Hittite forces coming out of an ambush upon him. He had been led astray by two Arabs who told him the Hittite army was far away when in fact they were right over the next rise. And in his eagerness to carry through this victory, Ramses had moved far ahead of his other army corps. But he was a warrior, Pharaoh, riding in his chariot, firing his bow. He held the line long enough for his elite troops to rush up and save the day. He won a victory at Kadesh, the site there in Syria, and one that he would celebrate in what we would call propaganda or news briefs all over his empire, carving them onto temples throughout Egypt. However, what he really had to make was a negotiated peace, which set up spheres of power, a balance of power between Egypt and the Hittites. And gradually, in the last years of the reign of Ramses, and it was a long, long reign, from 1279 down until 1213, the power of Egypt began to ebb. And from the outside, there came to the shores of Egypt strange peoples, some of them bearing names like Ikwash, which are simply the Achaeans of Homer, the Achaeans sung about in the Odyssey, raiding the coastline and going to the land of the lotus eaters, which was Egypt. And inside Egypt as well, there was turmoil, groups coming in and groups going out. And among those groups, I am quite convinced, were those peoples who would come to be known as the Israelites. The very name Moses gives us some cause for consideration. Moses is an Egyptian name. One of the greatest of Egypt's pharaohs was Thutmoses. The pharaohs were named Ra-Moses. So Moses is an Egyptian name. And the story is that the children of Israel had come originally into Egypt and been led there and brought there, starving and under famine. And one of the Israelites, Joseph, had risen to great power. Well, none of this is out of keeping with what we know of the real history of Egypt in the period of Ramses and before. That is to say, wandering tribes, Bedou, had come in from the deserts. There had been famine, and foreigners rose to high position in this day of imperial power that was Egypt. There's nothing out of the ordinary in that. And then we learn in the book of Exodus that a new Pharaoh came to power who knew not Joseph and laid hard tasks upon the Hebrew children. I think this Pharaoh was Ramses II, who was part of his empire building, sought to consolidate and centralize imperial power. Moses, you remember, had been raised as an Egyptian. The story was that he had been born a Hebrew child, but had been set afloat and found by an Egyptian princess and raised to be an Egyptian. Various ways to read that story, but one, of course, is that he was, in fact, really an Egyptian. And this was a way of making him, after the fact, into a Hebrew. However that may be, he was raised as an Egyptian, killed an Egyptian, righting a wrong, and fled into exile. And it was in exile that God found him and gave him his call. He's a shepherd, and he sees a bush burning, and he starts to go up to it, and there in exile, already an old man, he hears this voice boom out to him, "Take off your sandals, this is holy ground." "What is this?" Moses asked. "I am who I am. I am who I am." Sounds a bit like the Bhagavad Gita, doesn't it? Don't ask me, what is this? I am who I am. That is all you need to know. And moreover, you are to go and lead the Hebrews out of Egypt. I'm to lead the Hebrews out of Egypt? That's impossible. I'm an old man. You're to do it. Well, I can't speak well. I'm a very poor public speaker. We'll give you somebody to speak for you. You're going to do this. In other words, here's the prophet, the person who speaks forth. That is what the word really means. Prophemi, the person who speaks forth, who is reluctant. "I don't want to do this. I would rather do anything else in the world than to have to go back to Egypt, where there's a warrant for my arrest, and take on the government of Pharaoh, for which I have no qualifications whatsoever, and then to lead a people about whom I know almost nothing into I don't know where. Do it." And that is the call of the prophet. Do it. And Moses finds the meaning for his life in this absolute submission to the will of God. So you see, the book of Exodus, on the divine level, is the story of God and the acts of God in history. And on the personal level, it's about a man called to a great task and gaining his fame, his enduring meaning through the acceptance of this call. But Moses goes back with his brother and they go to Egypt, and there's Pharaoh astounded that these wanderers come in and say, "You know, you've got this group of people living there, Hibiru, which could well be an Egyptian word for wanderers, and you have enslaved them, and you're making them build your great cities out of brick." Well, the great cities of Egypt were in fact made out of mud brick. And in fact, you are making the task even harder for them. For not only do they have to make the bricks, they're now having to gather straw. And of course, Egyptian mud bricks are made with mud and straw to give them holding power, binding power. So already we're with details that speak of history. And if the Bhagavad Gita is a story for all time and all places, once upon a time is the Bhagavad Gita, meaning once upon a time, forever and ever and ever and ever. The Bible, the book of Exodus, these are works of history. And Hebrew thought is deeply rooted in history. And this deep rooting in history makes it, to my mind, absolutely improbable. More than improbable, impossible. That Moses is not a real historical figure, and that the Exodus is not a real historical event. So you are to let these children of Israel go. Well, no, I have enslaved a lot of people. And that is true. The Egyptian Empire was an imperial power that dominated many, and I'm not going to let this one group go. So God then begins to speak with a series of acts. The Nile runs red with blood, a plague of fleas, of lice and flies and gnats, frogs all over Egypt, darkness over the land, getting more and more and more severe. Well, you know, biblical scholars and also ordinary people just cannot deal today in our own 21st century with miracles. In fact, they haven't been able to deal with them since about 1800. How can you have miracles? So what you do is you go through and get rid of all these miracles or try to explain them. Oh, you know, sometimes there's a red tide in the Nile that makes it look red. Well, that's absolute nonsense. Either you accept the miracles or you don't. But you cannot rationalize them and leave the rest of the story. The point is that the miracles are the proof of God's power. And they are the proof to Pharaoh, and they are the proof to Moses. And we must also understand that until quite recently in history, perhaps as late as the 19th century, people took miracles seriously. They did occur in the minds of people. So in the minds of the audience, these miracles are real, and that is what matters to us. In the minds of the audience, in the minds of those who came to believe in the power of this God, I am, and in the power of Moses, these miracles were real. Pharaoh will time and time again relent, then harden his heart, until finally the most terrible of plagues strikes, and the firstborn child of the Egyptian dies. All over the land in the book of Exodus, there is mourning. But the Israelites themselves are passed over. They make the sign upon the lintel of their home, and they are passed over. And in their haste, they gird themselves up, eat a hasty meal with unleavened bread, and forever thereafter will remember this night of salvation as the Passover. And they leave Egypt under the guidance of Moses. But Pharaoh once again hardens his heart. After all, he can't have people leaving his empire. He must protect his borders. Isn't that true? There must be absolute security at the borders. And so he starts off after them with his chariot corps once again riding after them. And they come to the Red Sea, and again in a miracle that those who were there believed happened. The sea parts, and the children of Israel pass across. But when Pharaoh and his army try to pass across, why, the sea closes back in upon them and destroys them. Well, surely, and I agree with scholars, if Egyptian records exist in such detail as they do, that the absolute destruction of Pharaoh and his army would be recorded, no doubt about that. That may have been exaggerated. However, the earliest single piece of the Bible is there in Exodus, the earliest text. And it is the song of rejoicing. The horse and his rider, he has thrown into the sea. The Lord has triumphed. Blessed be his name. Now that kernel represents real history and the deliverance from a historical danger. The horse and his rider, he has thrown into the sea. God has thrown into the sea. Blessed be God. He has triumphed gloriously. So the Jewish people begin in real history and a real event. It may well be that they were an assortment of people suffering servitude in Egypt who found this great charismatic leader who brought them together and led them into a new land and gave them a history. And that is why the insistent tradition that Moses composed in some fashion Genesis and the other first five books of the Bible, composed in some fashion that kernel, may rest upon his realization of the need for people to have a common history and common rights that separated them from other people. And at the same time, bearing the legacy of the time in Egypt, such as the distaste for eating pork, or circumcision, a rite among the Egyptians, a rite among the Hebrews, a rite of initiation, a characteristic separation of others. Remember how God orders David to bring him the foreskins of the enemy that they have slain in tribute. So they have made their way out of Egypt under Moses, and now begin the long period of wandering in search of the Holy Land, in search of the promised land that has been granted to them. A holy land because it continues still to be the scene of warfare and conflict over so many who believe it to be their holy land. And Moses, in their wandering in the desert, brings them to Mount Sinai, that strange place in the middle of a burning desert where the beautiful little monastery still sits today. And you can climb up the steps that the monks believe were those that led Moses up to Sinai, hewn out there of the rock. And there, a magnificent event occurred that would forever shape not just the history of the Israelites, but the history of all that would come after, echoing down to our own day and still able to cause controversy in our own day. For God spoke to Moses in the story of Exodus and gave him the law under which the Israelites were to make their absolute submission to him, the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments, as we have them, are fully in a historical context. They reflect what we know about how treaties were made in the Middle East of the age of the Egyptian and Hittite empires, in the age of, the 13th century B.C. It is a treaty in which an absolute ruler, a king, makes an agreement to protect a people if they accept his absolute domination. So it is in no way a compact between equals. It reflects the Middle Eastern, the Mesopotamian definition of freedom as a right or privilege granted to you by an absolute ruler. The absolute ruler grants you freedom from taxation, freedom to live in a particular area. It is not freedom to live as you choose. It is something that the absolute ruler can take away from you at any moment if you disobey his will. And he lays down the stipulations and begins by declaring, I am the Lord thy God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of bondage. So the history of the Israelites begins in liberation and in freedom. Freedom from the slavery of Egypt, this great boon bestowed upon them by I am the God, by Yahweh, as his powerful name will echo, by Yahweh. You will have no other gods beside me. In other words, this grant of freedom that I have given you and can take away whenever I wish is absolutely dependent upon your worship in me and no other divinity. So it is monotheism in its most extreme form. No swerving, no deviation. And you will make no graven images. That is a second stipulation that I lay down for you. No graven images will be made. I do not want your setting up idols, false gods that you can give many forms to. You will not take my name in vain. You will not swear oaths, including my name in it, that you then break. So the essential theme of truth appears here in the Ten Commandments. God is a God of truth, of absolute truth, and you are not to breach that truth in any way. And you are to show your obedience to me by keeping one day out of seven absolutely free from work. Call it the Sabbath. On 6 days you will labor, on that seventh you will not. Now those are the terms you have to keep to show your honor to me. A festival day every seventh day in honor of me. And honor your father and mother as we make the bridge from the commandments to God to the commandments to how to treat your neighbor. Honor your father and mother. See, that almost puts parents on a semi-deified level, doesn't it? They're the bridge between you and the rest of the world. Honor them. And then, do not kill. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. And do not be jealous. Do not covet. Ah, what a profound message that is for us that we break every day. But these are absolute prohibitions. Do not kill. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not lie. And do not be jealous. So for our question, our theme, are there absolute truths? Well, the book of Exodus could not be clearer. There are absolute truths, and you must not disobey them. And in following this code, then you will have salvation. And you will have freedom. Break that code, and destruction and enslavement is yours. The book of Exodus is a book of social justice as well. Elaborating the stern Ten Commandments in order to set up an entire social system. Balancing the need for justice with that of compassion. And the God of Exodus, this book of God, is about a God who is vengeful, stern, and at the same time forgiving and compassionate. It is a book about human weakness. And no sooner do they have the Ten Commandments with the commandment not to make any graven image, than they run off and make a golden calf and start worshiping it. You've got to have something that you can see. Moses again and again intercedes for his people. They are just weak. They are just human. And again, God relents and forgives and treats the Israelites with compassion. Moses himself, this great prophet who brought the Israelites out of bondage and gave them the law that was to guide them, would never see the promised land. God would withhold that from him. But the Israelites would move on into the land of Canaan, and with fire and sword, as described in the Old Testament, they would take it as theirs, their land. That too, the conquest by fire and sword of the land of Canaan, is attested in the archaeological record. So the Exodus, the conquest of Canaan, these are real historical events, along with a real historical figure, Moses. Where did the idea of monotheism come from? It too has its roots in Egypt. Egypt was a nation of polytheism, worshiping many gods in many forms, the jackal-headed god Anubis, the cow-headed god Hathor. But one powerful mind in the history of Egypt stood up against this. He was Pharaoh, Akhenaten. Pharaoh from 1352 to 1326. In other words, within a generation or two of Moses himself. And against all the tradition of Egypt, Akhenaten put forth the view that there was only one God, the Aten. The Aten, whose beauty was shown in the sun itself. A God all-powerful, a God under whom the whole of the universe lived and prospered. And Akhenaten wrote hymns, magnificent psalms, to his God, describing how the little chick in its shell is warmed by the rays of the great God. And how there is unity in the world, and the God himself cares for people from far off Africa all the way to the great sea that is the Mediterranean. There is unity and brotherhood under the grandeur of this great God. Well, all this power is of Pharaoh. Akhenaten could not impose this upon Egypt. He was broken, and the priest came back with a vigor and fervor and destroyed all the temples that had been built to Aten. But that idea lived on. And I believe, though many would disagree with me, I believe that the seed of that belief in monotheism would percolate throughout Egypt, live on, and then find a new a more noble, a more enduring form in the prophet Moses and in his great mission that would transform history. Most certainly, the book of Exodus in the Bible is a work that has made history. And we see time and time again, it is a work and a book with its Ten Commandments that can still arouse controversy and the deepest possible feelings among us. In our society that doesn't want absolutes, doesn't want commandments.